Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mindshifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love in Aramaic Rachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about Michael or myself or the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mindshifters Radio.
Hi, and welcome to the show. Today is April the 11th, 2018, and our call-in number is 563-999-3581. Press 1, and that puts you in queue to talk to us, and we would love to hear your comments and your questions, because that makes this your show. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. You listen to that voice that does that introduction. Isn't that a sweet voice? I love your accent, honey. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. In any event,
so you went and got some oil today?
I got my oil changed. Yes, I'm right here in Tennessee getting my oil changed. Yep, that's what I did. Oh, dear. I knew I'd been hanging around Tennessee too long the last time I went into this, and I did say I went in to get my oil change. No, it's oil, actually. But anyway, as Jeannie says, the only person who noticed it was me, so what's the difference? Well, the difference is that we're here to learn about forgiveness. We're here to look at the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness and integrate it into absolutely everything that we do. And our Course in Miracles lesson to start out today actually takes advantage of one of the things we know about carbon-based memory. And that is that there's a thing that we call the file folder effect. And the file folder effect says that when two files fire together, they wire together. An example of that that I usually use, most of you probably heard me use it before, is that inform people in a workshop that I'm going to wire two files together in their minds that have probably never been wired together before. And knowing that people have brain cells for these two different ideas, I know that if I can fire those two files together, then they're going to connect to each other. And so I use the example of don't think about a purple alligator. And, of course, you can't not think about a purple alligator. The mind works by resonance. And once those brain cells fire, then they're going to be linked together. You know, if I started tomorrow's show and said don't think about a purple, what would everybody's mind do? It would automatically resonate alligator because those two things have now been linked in your mind. Now, if 25 years from now I started the show and hadn't made reference to it in 25 years and said, don't think about a purple alligator, what would resonate in your mind? Well, the word alligator would resonate because once those files are linked, that's a done deal. However, very likely, since you hadn't thought about a purple alligator in 25 years, those firings of brain cells might not come to conscious awareness. So you might go, purple something, oh, there's something down there, I don't remember what it is, you know, it's on the tip of my tongue, I don't, and the stuff that we say that's on the tip of my tongue, that's information that's firing at an unconscious level. And so when things fire in the unconscious mind, they impact perceptions, decisions, and behaviors. Really important thing to understand. In the Aramaic, there was a total understanding of the unconscious, and there was actually a suffix, O-O-T-A, that when they added it to a word, indicated that whatever that word represented was something that was firing at an unconscious level in the mind, and it impacted, shifted, changed. perceptions, decisions, and behaviors. And so most people, when we reference our lesson today, most people think about needing strength. And in my experience, what most people turn to is their hostility, their fear, their rage. And they think that protection comes from fear and strength comes from anger. And so press us up when the chips are down, we watch the average person in our culture and they'll turn to some form of hostility in an effort to gather strength. And what happens is that, in fact, the presence of the frequency, I love what Einstein says about anger. He says, anger only happens in the bosom of fools. It reduces our perceptual capacity, our perceptual acuity when we're angry. Notice that if you think about all the times that you've done something you regretted, hostility or anger was one of the things that comes in there as a close second, if not first, in every event. It reduces perception. If you ever look at things that you've regretted, anger is going to come in there as at least a close second, if not number one. When did you do something you regretted? What was it that you were feeling that motivated you to do that? It was anger. So there's behavior. And, of course, our decisions come about as a result of what's firing in the mind. So this particular lesson from the Course is working to rewire the mind so that we begin to see that strength comes. So the lesson is miracles are seen in light, and light and strength are one. So we get to shift out of the normal mind's perceptual constructs when we tap into the active presence of love. When we connect to that active presence of love and or light, then our whole perceptual system shifts out of the past and carbon-based memory into the ability to perceive accurately what's going on in the external world rather than perceive from the mind in the past. And so if we're under stress, gee, this thing's not going the way I'd like it to be. Several of my goals are being violated. What I want to do is train my carbon-based memory system, my body's mind. I want to train my multi-generational database to shift into light and love if I'm under stress, rather than shift into the reduced perception, decisions, and behaviors that come with hostility and fear. And so this lesson is a powerful piece in the puzzle. And if we'll work with that idea and really come to the point of recognizing that I get to see a whole different game being played out, that's called a miracle, when my perception is keyed to the active presence of love. So that's where we want to go, is into understanding that and then spending time with that idea, spending time just quietly meditating on that idea, being with it, and linking to your mind that your highest intelligence, your highest capacity, literally your highest physiological strength is going to come from that connection to that activity of love. You know, we've all heard about the mother or the father who watched their child being crushed under a car. The car fell off the jack. The child was under there, and the parent goes over and lifts the car off the child. Now, I guarantee you that if we had somebody standing over there, and people will talk about how they get stronger with anger, I guarantee you somebody standing over there who's angry and all isn't going to want to lift that car off the kid. It's the parent who has such a care, such a concern, such a connection to love, that the active presence of love empowers every cell in the structure, and that's where our highest and best perception comes from. That's where truth comes from, and that's where we function at our best. And so that's our Course in Miracles lesson for today. And Dr. Tim, do you have anything to share with us today?
Well, I'm here.
Awesome. How do you be? What's exciting?
Well, I'm in the middle of in between sessions and teaching people how to observe. I was just listening between sessions to a little Alan Watts, and Alan was holding forth about Krishnamurti. and how when you're in a situation with Krishnamurti, it gets very stifling and frustrating because he refuses to answer your questions directly. He answers your questions with questions. The point of which is that the meaning in the words isn't in the words, it's in the brain cells of the person who's hearing them or responding to them. And so it reminded me of last night in the group, we had somebody once again asking questions and trying to pin something down with what's the meaning of these words or what does it mean when a spiritual teacher says this or that. And to summarize very briefly what Krishnamurti would say to that is to say, you need to just keep questioning without demanding an answer. You need to be working on developing this ability to live in the question and understand that life is a mystery and you are a mystery, and in that active observing space and questioning space, all kinds of things can be revealed. But when I enter into the space of demanding that I know the answer so I can say I'm right and the other person's wrong, I cut off learning, I cut off my connection to this flow of life. And so that's been a theme today in sessions, not surprisingly, that we're trying to help people understand that a good set of questions and learning to live in that question, appreciation for the question, is better than deciding I know what's right and I'm wrong and the other person is right, or I'm right and the other person's wrong. And so if we stay in the flow, we don't get so stuck. So that's my offering for today.
Sounds right on track. Living in the question can be a challenge to the non-being mind because it wants to know. And it wants everybody to know that it knows. That tends to be a game. So definitely a game changer when you're willing to live in that question. And then, of course, with that comes the willingness to be taught. The willingness to receive answers. And as I receive answers, as I'm available to be taught, then I'm available for a whole different input than what my carbon-based memory or my what's called mind would give me. So, awesome. Very cool. Well, I ran across a quote that I'd like to share with everybody. You know, we've talked over and over about this idea that mind energy becomes flesh. The opening words in the book of John do not say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh. They say, in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became flesh. And when I realized that it's mind energy is the key to this whole game, then I have the opportunity to become the conscious source of the mind energy that I engage in, that I came across. And, you know, it's just like here we are, a mathematician, a physicist, astronomer, almost 2,000 years down the road, comes along and says precisely what Yeshua said 2,000 years ago. I mean, to a T. So here's a mathematician named Sir James Jeans, mathematician, physicist, astronomer. And here's what he says as a physicist, scientist. Today, there is a wide measure of agreement, which on the physical side of science approaches almost unanimity, that the stream of knowledge is heading towards a non-mechanical reality. The universe begins to look more like a great thought than a great machine. Mind no longer appears as an accidental intruder into the realm of matter. We are beginning to suspect that we ought rather to hail it as the creator and governor of the realm of matter. Quoted Einstein when he says, on such things as matter, we have been all wrong. What we've heretofore called matter is energy, energy whose vibrations have been so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses. There is no matter. Yet our senses are fooled because we think our perception is showing us something external, something physical, and something that's actually there as we see it. When the truth is, that's a long, long way from the truth. Max Planck, back in this is over 100 years ago, is receiving the Nobel Prize in Physics. And he says, as a man who spent his entire life studying matter, I can tell you this much. There is no matter as such. Our entire world, he says, is made of succeedingly smaller patterns of vibratory fields nested one within another, within another. According to Sir James Jeans, according to Yeshua, he says, it's mind energy. Now you listen to Candace Pert in her book, Molecules of Emotion. And Candace says that these neuropeptides that represent feelings, which are really simply reflections of thoughts, are, in her words, the sheet music that direct the whole process of physiology. Are you facing a disease process in your physiology, in your relationships, in your creative process? If you are, then mind is the matter. Now, the old way of thinking in the mechanical universe was that the mind doesn't matter, but in fact, the mind does literally matter. It's what organizes and turns things into matter. And that's why when we have thought disorders, thoughts based in hatred and anger and sadness and fear that we try to force into this physiological system that's made for the active presence of love, that's why we end up in pain. That's why we end up in trauma. That's why we end up in turmoil. Because we're trying to force a frequency, an energy, a nested frequency or pattern into a structure that it doesn't belong in. And when you put it into a structure that it doesn't belong in, then the structure becomes disordered or diseased. So one of the things that we're here to do with this work is to understand the source of all disease and to be willing to become responsible for every thought disorder that we have and bring correction to it. How do you tell if you've got a thought disorder? You're in pain. You look at a situation. Your mind is either consciously or unconsciously cycling information, what's been called thought. And that presence of thought, pardon me, that does not belong in the system, warns you that there's something going on in the system that doesn't belong there. Mind energy becomes flesh. And when we correct the system, then the whole game changes. And that's the game that we're here to change. Dr. Tim, any thoughts on that idea for you?
Well, just that my observation is that the more I practice being aware of every internal sensation of discomfort or frustration, and then turn the focus inside rather than outside. As soon as I do that and then make an adjustment in my thoughts, I experience a difference. I experience the relief. It'll either move from one negative emotion to another, or it will dissipate a physical tension in me. So my experience is that's really how it works, and I just encourage people to play with it. I remember how resistant I was when I first heard these kinds of things. It couldn't be that easy. It can't be that I'm causing this. I had many levels of resistance to it, and yet the more I actually practiced it, the more I saw, you know what, that's the way it works for me. So if that's the way it's going to work, I might as well get on board and see what I can do to shift my thoughts every time I'm uncomfortable, hoping there's a different way to think about things that leaves me with more comfort, more ease, more joy, more life.
For sure. For sure. Well, let's check with Jeannie and see if she has any hands up in the phone queue or anything happening in the chat room to be aware of. Jeannie?
We actually do have a hand up. And there's several people in the chat room, so that must mean that it's working a little bit today. Our caller is area code 610. You're on the air. Who do we have?
Hi, it's Susan in Pennsylvania. Hi, everybody.
Hey, young lady. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks. Michael,
what's exciting
you
in your world? How can
about?
We support you today?
Well, I have a question to start. I have a couple of questions, but the first one is I'm remembering what you just said and the fact that pain, if it shows up in your system, means something needs to be worked through. You were telling me yesterday about the grief you felt about those hockey players. And my feeling about your describing that was that that was such a gorgeous thing. It was a loving joining with the grieving families, the injured kids, the kids who had died. It seemed like totally appropriate. Now, I don't know whether you were totally undone by that and that made it over the limit of normal or healthy, but tell me where the line is drawn. You experienced what I would think is just a kind of pain that an empathic person would feel. And I didn't see anything. I didn't understand why you might have had to do a worksheet on it. You didn't say you did. But could you just talk about that a little bit? Did you?
Sure. Yes. I did several. Yes.
Okay.
And here's my take. Let me just see. Give me just a second here. So let's go back to the foundation of the work. I hold the newborn child, and I experience the essence of that newborn as the presence of love.
Mm-hmm.
And I deem it reasonable to conclude, seeing as how everybody around the globe that I ask when they hold a newborn to describe the essence of the newborn, that everybody's word is some variation on the theme of love, that human life must be love. Is that a reasonable conclusion to come to?
Yeah.
So if that's a reasonable conclusion to come to, then I should be able to, if I am the presence of love, experience everything that happens in my world out of the presence of love. And my take is, you know, for me, for my own personal work, and this is just for me, and of course the invitation to others to look at and see how it fits for them, is that if I'm not experiencing myself as the presence of love, in the presence of this trauma that I'm observing, then I have surrendered to something inside of me that is less than love. And I can forgive that which is less than love in me and stand there totally, completely empathetic with what has just happened. Certainly not staying there going, rah, rah, yay, look what just happened, but rather stand there as the presence of love, bringing forward the presence of love to be the salve that helps the person who's lost in their trauma to recover from their trauma.
Mm-hmm. And where
now,
does your feeling...
If I could have reached in and, you know, touched the driver's hand of the transport truck that hit the school bus, would I have gone back in time and done that? Absolutely. Then who knows what I might have put into motion if I had the power to do that. Fortunately, I don't.
Yeah.
But to bring to tragedy the presence of love to me is always a desirable thing. And if I'm bringing something other than that to the experience, then I'm tarnishing the experience.
Okay, I understand that. I really do. That was well put. I didn't perceive what you said as tarnishing, but you experienced it as tarnishing, evidently. To me, it just seemed like compassion. It just seemed like a very loving response and an identifying with these people in trauma. It seemed like a wonderful thing to do. But you, of course, you know. So evidently something else was going on that was above and beyond that, which was not healthy or useful. Helpful.
Yeah, it brought up a pretty big layer of grief for me. I don't know if there's a pen or something dragging, or is this microphone dragging across a table or something. There's a loud clicking noise going on. I don't know if there's somebody else in the background, Gene, that we can mute or...
I'm not doing anything.
I'm not doing anything.
Yeah. Okay. All
right. I don't know if anybody else is hearing it, but I'm hearing a strong rustling of something going on in the background.
Weird. I don't hear it.
So that would be my take on it, is I want to bring love to the presence of that experience. You know, if I've come face to face with someone who's lost a loved one and I haven't resolved what's in me about losing loved ones and I'm in pain and trauma, then if I bring pain and trauma to them, then I'm resonating, I'm adding to their pain and trauma, which to me doesn't seem to be a very fitting or uplifting thing to do. Cure as the presence of love to this person's trauma, then I can hold the space and, as I say, be the salve that supports them in healing.
And
but
does
I can't
that mean
support
you
them
wouldn't...
in healing it if I'm in the same boat.
And if you're feeling sorrow for them, is that in the same boat?
Sorrow to me. Well, remember that I can't feel sorrow for anyone. I can feel sorrow because there are thoughts of sorrow in me.
Yeah.
And when those thoughts of sorrow move, then I feel sorrow, and sorrow tarnishes the presence of love, creates an interference over top of the presence of love. So what I chose to do in that situation, I felt a great deal of grief. That's what was resonated in me by reading about this event. And so I realized that I had some unresolved grief. And it was, you know, in the worksheets that I did, it was non-specific. It wasn't, I didn't come up with an ABC thought, you know, if I had been that, you know, 14-year-old on that bus, how sad my family. I didn't come up with anything specific. I was just with it, breathing it, and looking for every goal I could possibly hold in that situation. And it was it was non-specific. The healing process for me, and it was non-specific. And I did a little more work after the show yesterday, because as I spoke about it, like the day before when I read about it, I came downstairs and I could hardly speak without being just in tears.
Yeah.
And I could speak about it on the show yesterday. There was a little bit of emotion there, but not a lot. So I had moved out some of it, but I wasn't finished with it. And today, as I speak about it, and of course we're not speaking in depth and detail as I did yesterday, but right now there's no sensation of that present for me at all. So for me, that says, okay, I've done some work around that. Maybe there'll be another layer of that. Maybe there won't.
Yeah. I have some ideas in my head that are not useful. Like if you are not expressing or feeling sorrow, then you're being cold. And I know you've just explained and I understand it, but for me to be aware and brave enough to let my image of being a compassionate person go, that's what it is. I want to be seen that way.
Well, you know, we live in a culture that has a multi-billion-dollar business in selling sympathy cards. And sympathy, you know, if you look at the word resonance, one of the bases of this work is the idea of resonance. I hit a middle C tuning fork on a desk. It's that tuning fork that's of a similar frequency and resonance. And that's actually called sympathetic resonance. It's an exchange of energy. So for me, if I walk into someone's space who's just lost a loved one, for me to have sorrow that matches their sorrow, I'm bouncing off of and resonating in a realm that's less than the presence of love. To me, compassion would look like, wow, I can see that you're hurting. I perhaps can't comprehend the hurt because I haven't been in that exact same space, or I've been in that same space and I've worked through that hurt, and I stand here as a tuning fork for love to lift you into the truth of who you are, for you to resolve the pain that you hold, so that for this soul that's wending its way on in its journey, you, having a deep link with them, can be the space that uplifts them as well as your own life. So to me, that would be what compassion would look like. It wouldn't look like me standing in my sorrow and my pain, matching their sorrow and their pain, sympathetic resonance. That's not compassion for me.
So, Susan.
Yeah.
It seemed that right before Michael started talking the last time, you tapped into something when you said that you want to be seen as compassionate, and it seemed in your voice that you were tapping into some emotions.
Mm. Yeah. I've been in them. Right.
So I would encourage you to just breathe into that without all the words.
Mm-hmm.
And watch what comes up and see what the goal is. What's loaded into the goal of you being seen as compassionate?
I've got such an overlay of anxiety about my grandson that it's hard to get into that, but I am not going to forget what you suggested because I bet there's stuff there to work on. Which leads me to another question, and that is, Eckhart Tolle used to talk about the pain body. In his books, he mentions how the pain body just, you'll be going along fine, and suddenly the pain body is there again. And I wanted to ask you, it sounds like a cyclical thing or a recurring thing, that, of course, it means it needs clearing up, the worksheets need to be done, but has it been either of your experiences that certain feelings, like for me it's anxiety and depression, it just, I have bouts of it, and it always manages to attach itself to a certain situation, and right now it's attached to what's going on with my grandson, but if it weren't my grandson, it would probably be something else.
Yeah, who knows, your grandson may be a fully realized conscious being saying, you know, Grandma really needs to get this stuff up and out of her and healed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to play this role of the victim with my father so that she can get to look at this victimhood stuff that she holds about young men being victims of their fathers.
Well, that makes it all about me, and that's very kind of him, but I don't really think that's the case. I mean, in a bigger sense, maybe it is, that we all have to learn stuff. Yeah.
But your pain is all about you. That's the point. Your pain is all about you. It's not about him at all.
Okay.
Your mind uses that as a screen of projection. I was just presenting the possibility. What if he were a fully conscious, realized being and said, so I'm going to play this role for Grandma? Because your pain is all about you.
Yeah. And Tim, there's the circle. You just said, what comes up for you about compassion? Well, this isn't compassion, is it? I mean, real compassion would be what Michael just said, an active, present love and peace. And since I'm not doing that, I'm not being compassionate. Boy, oh boy, you guys are amazing. The two of you are like this amazing team. Yeah, I got it.
So we are here to breathe with you and to support you coming to the point where you can come to your grandson as a fully connected, realized spiritual being and be the space that is so safe that everything that's going on inside of him and his father is able to open to them. And they're able to process through it in the presence of your love, if they choose to. And they may not.
Yeah.
They may choose to go on with this game for the next 30 years. And your grandson may pass it on to his son. But
yeah.
I offer that the best chance
of the other option happening is when somebody, probably somebody in the genetic chain who's tied into this trauma, at least through their epigenetic or perhaps directly through their genes, processes through that, brings all of that that is in them to the presence of love and heals it, and then stands in their presence in compassion.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's coming to visit on Friday.
Awesome.
Yeah. I want him to listen to your show, and he might do that. He's pretty open. So, but I, judging from what you've just said, I think I got it. But it's going to take really preparing for this Friday. I want to be that person for him on Friday. I want to be there and not be just an anxious grandmother who's fussing, which is what I've been pretty much.
So grandma's worksheets are going to be about anxiety and fussing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I support you going through that one and being free of it.
Thanks. Thank you.
Because you know what? He doesn't deserve your anxiety and your fussing, and neither do you.
No, no. There are some practical things, but maybe the answers will come. I mean, there is the fear that he is addicted to something, and certain situations at school and a car accident point in that direction. He denies it, but I don't want to be a critical grandmother who says, tisk, tisk, you know, you're a bad boy.
So you want to be a critical grandmother? Is that what I hear?
Yep, you heard that.
So how did it feel when your grandmother was critical of you?
She wasn't. She was a very gentle little lady who died when I was quite young, and the other grandmother died before I really knew her at all. I was about 3, 4. So I'll ask the question in another way and see where it fits. Certainly my mother was critical, but my grandmothers weren't. I was the 5th kid in a big family, and so by the time grandmothers, we came around, grandmothers were already pooped and heading out.
So perhaps, what age were you? Do you have recall
when
of your grandmother leaving?
When my paternal grandmother died, I was 4, I think, and my maternal when I was 9. And she was a very quiet, shy, timid, gentle little lady. So, and she just adored us. I don't remember her ever being critical.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, then you might shift worksheet towards mom and see if that opens anything up. And yes, fortunately, most grandmothers get to play the role of the sweetness, and then when the stress is up and the chips are down, send the kids home.
Yeah, I know. That's true.
Definitely one of the benefits of grandmotherhood compared to motherhood.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are sort of functioning as the paternal grandmother, Luki's paternal grandmother, and I have formed this incredible friendship, which seems amazing to me and such a great gift. And I've told the grandson, I said, you know, this is a lot of shit hitting a lot of fan, but we have become good friends thanks to you and thanks to all this little byproduct that you didn't need to have to deliver to us, but there it is. And he said, oh, that's so great, I'm so glad, because I love you both so much. He's such a sweet kid to say that.
So
but
remember
he's
we
coming
started
to
the
us
show out.
What?
Go ahead. I was going
to
start to say,
we
started the show up with this idea of mind energy becoming flesh.
Yeah.
And if you and grandma have joined and created this wonderful friendship around your grandson being in trauma, perhaps that would be a friendship to let go of and forgive and
open that friendship on a new level around a healed grandson, where two grandmothers out of their own healed state are joined in this incredible friendship and space of support and healing for this young man.
I think we're doing that, Michael. I'm not sure. I mean, what makes you think we aren't? Yeah.
No, I was just listening to the language around it. It sounded like maybe the joining was around his trauma. And so I was just saying, if there is any of that, that would be a good place to forgive.
Yeah. Wow, what an interesting idea. He's coming to our house admitting that he's smoking pot. And we've told him that we do not want him to smoke around the local grandkids and not in our house or their house. And he has agreed to that. I'm wondering whether I should go further and say, I don't want you smoking at all, get tough. I just have a lot of questions and I don't know how to be about that.
Well, you know, my take would be that it would be one of two results from that. I think it's very reasonable to say not around us or around the other kids. And to put a hard line up he might go, oh, I respect you so much, I'm going to quit. Or he might just go into resentment and separate from you too. Chances are his father has been hard line and put up some you know, rules that say, if you don't, then you're gone. And he said, okay, I'm going to, and so I'm gone. So that probably wouldn't be overly productive. However, you might. Have you got a copy of that poster that we've talked about from Ammon's website?
No. Ammon. A-M-M-O-N?
I'll find a copy of this poster and send it to you. And it's a poster that shows what electrical tracings, what the energy fields are around the brain when it's operating properly, and what the energy fields are that show the function of the brain when it's in trauma or not operating properly. And so there are two pictures that show a tracing from the top, a top view and a bottom view. So you get to see what a happy, healthy brain looks like. And then there are several pictures around it where someone's been a smoker for 20 years, where someone is an alcoholic. I forget what all they are, but there's several different, obviously, brains in trauma. And when you look at them and you realize that proper function means this whole, rounded, full functioning energy field, the most disastrous, I mean, instantly when you look at the poster, the most disastrous looking brain in the picture is a young man of 16 years of age who's been smoking pot for 2 years.
Okay.
Perhaps spending, I'll get a copy of it and send it to you, but perhaps, you know, spending some time with him on, you know, I know you live in a culture that tells you pot is good and they're making billions of dollars and they're telling you all kinds of research about all the wonderful things. And there are some wonderful things, and it actually isn't the THC, but it's the cannabinoids. There are cannabinoid receptors in the brain and throughout the body that, you know, I mean, the cannabinoids can do some pretty amazing things. But they're now turning that into, and here's why you should be smoking as much pot as you can, because, of course, there are billions of dollars to be made in it.
Mm-hmm.
But you might, you know, come to him from the point of view of, and here's why I'd like you not to be smoking around this. Here's why I want you to keep our other grandchildren clear of it. And ultimately, you know, you're a big boy. You're going to make your choices. You obviously already have. But here's why I'd like you to really seriously look at this and consider this, because this is the kind of damage that's being done that the people who are selling you pot are not telling you about. And I'd love to see you have a healthy, functional. I know I work with people in their 50s and 60s that were heavy pot smokers when they were kids, and they're in big time trauma and terror because their brains are going fried at a very young age. And they're like, you know, gee, I'm just not functioning very well. And they're realizing that it's from their days of heavy pot use. According to Ammons, it takes about a year to detox the brain and get it back on track.
Wow. This would be extremely helpful. And it also provides a pathway for me to just present stuff to him without being a taskmaster or making a judgment. I'm not judging him.
Yeah,
I just want him to have the information. That is so good.
Yeah.
Good, good, good. Thank you.
Cool. I will get that to you. And there's some other information,
Michael,
I'll get to you as well. Absolutely delighted.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. Thank
All
you
right,
so much.
Blessings. All right, anything
you
else
too.
On your mind?
No, go ahead and just carry on. There's probably somebody else needing to talk. This is wonderful. Thank you. Oh, I got it. Bing.
All right.
Jeannie's thing just came through.
Oh,
thanks.
The poster? Oh, great.
Yeah,
thank
I think
you,
so.
Please
I got
throw
a text.
On it.
Say that again, Michael.
I say she
I'm
is included. So on it.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I wanted
yeah.
to say that little iPhone app is fabulous. How
Isn't
she
it awesome?
Did that, that it could print out the whole worksheet and type it in there. I don't know how you did that. That's just a piece of genius.
I have watched
oh, yeah.
her work on that so many hours, like giant accolades, and thank yous to Jeannie for that.
Oh,
it's pretty
beautiful
awesome.
And easy to use and, you know, just great. Thank you.
Well, if
thank
you would go into,
too.
Go into the iPhone store and do that review and then maybe
yeah.
post a link on your Facebook page and let people that you know about it. Because I'm getting feedback from people who don't know anything about the process and somebody told them about the app and they just went in and started filling in the blanks. They're going, wow, my life has changed.
Hey.
They don't know anything else about it but that. So
fantastic, yeah.
This may be the key to the next level of critical mass with this tool on a global scale.
Oh, man, it's going to go crazy out there. It's going to go out there all around. Yeah, I'll do that.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you, too.
Delighted. Delighted to be on your team and to have you on ours.
Thanks, Michael. Everybody
and
else
we hold
the
space
too.
For Grant. It will be delightful if he chooses to call in to have a conversation with him.
Yeah, I'd love it. I'd love it. I'll encourage that.
All right. Well, any other thoughts before we check the phone log and see if we've got another caller?
Are you asking Susan that? I'll put her back on. I had
oh,
her on mute.
No, I don't. Go ahead. No, thanks. That's great. Thank you.
Okay. Blessings.
Thanks.
All right. Well, Jeannie?
There's Joanna is in the chat room, and so I also sent her the same spec gallery information. And she said, if time permits, she would like for you to say more about discreating the grandma friendships around trauma and recreating the friendship around a healthy grandson.
Sure. Sure. That would be a good topic. And, you know, my take would be that I would look at, you know, I'd be using the forgiveness process. I would be using the commitment, you know, the commitment from the healing through relationships. And I'd be speaking the commitment, if I were in Susan's shoes right now, I'd be speaking the commitment to my grandson, to my grandson's father, my son. I'd be speaking the commitment to the other grandmother. And then I'd be doing the forgiveness process and look at all the goals that I have that relate to the trauma that they're going through.
I don't know if it's my phone or if you just kind of disappeared, Michael. Did
it's
someone
Michael.
Else will pop in?
It's Michael.
Okay, it's Michael. All right, so check and see if your headset's come loose or something, because it's like we can barely hear about every fourth word. And it just started.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, well, I don't know what happened. Nothing's changed, although I am on a cell phone, so maybe it's a signal for your cell phone.
Okay. And you were talking about reading the commitment, and then shortly after that, it started just cutting out.
Okay. So for me, it would be a dual process. One side is the forgiveness work, removing the energies that link us around trauma. The other side would be strengthening the energies that link us around the presence of love. So the commitment would be a way of strengthening the energies that link us to
the presence of love. And I'd be speaking the commitment to my son, perhaps just to his picture, if it's not appropriate to do it face-to-face or over the telephone, to my grandson. You know, this could be another conversation to have with him. And here's a replacement that will take you much higher than thought ever thought of. When you start to live out of this as your personal code, and this is the personal code that I want to live with you and speak the commitment. And then the forgiveness process would be that of what are all the traumas that there have been discussions about between the two grandmothers? You know, every conversation about the son, the grandson, or about themselves, or the way they relate to it, or what's happened to them, you know, whatever conversation's taken place, I'd be looking at every circumstance and event there and applying the forgiveness process in those arenas. So that, for me, would be the way to go. And Dr. Tim, and of course, sitting in just a quiet meditative space and bringing forward that presence of love into all of the interactions between the four of you and or anyone else that's involved in the conversation. Tim, you have any thoughts to add?
Well, I think you've covered it nicely. Part of the thing that we're taught to do in this culture is to commiserate, which is actually just a form of gossip. And so one of the, I keep talking to people about a two-prong approach, and you just outlined that two-prong approach. I want to practice strengthening my ability to focus on my true nature as love, and then I want to actively work to dismantle or integrate anything that comes up that's less than that. And so in our culture, we're taught to sit around and talk about other people when they're not there and how horrible this was and how, what are these possible solutions? What could we do? How can we change them? How can we get them to change? And it really is counterproductive. What I found much more productive is for me to sit and send visions of wholeness that I can tap into in my awareness of my true nature and realize everybody else is made of the same stuff and that's their true nature. And this brings me back to your definition from the ancient Aramaic of the word humility, which is that capacity to look for and find the highest and best in another person and then choose to cooperate only with that highest and best energy, regardless of what other actions or behaviors or energies they might be displaying, and continually remind myself that everyone I encounter, whether it's face-to-face or in my thoughts, is a being of brilliance and light, just like myself, who has either only partially, temporarily forgotten or has yet to discover their brilliance and their light. And spending time in that realization, spending time adding my mind energy to that observation of reality is far more productive than commiserating about the tragedy, etc.
I be with you. And it looks like we've got about 5 or so minutes left. So, Jeannie, do we have another hand up in the phone queue or anything happening in the chat room? I'm glad it's working. Maybe we're getting them back on track with that.
We actually do have a hand up, and it's a Skype caller. So you are on the air. Who do we have, and where are you calling from? Skype caller, you are on the air. And maybe it's not Skype caller and it's just showing up as that. I know sometimes Tracy has called in and it looks like a Skype caller. So, it is you.
Well, that is just so strange. I'm sitting in the.
What a great guest.
Pardon?
I say what a great guest that you guessed your name is the Skype caller.
I'm sitting in my conservatory looking at the beautiful flowers and all these azaleas in the backyard, just thanking God I can see it all. And I'm like, whoa, I didn't even know it was me. So I wanted to also say love, 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 love the app. Thank you, Jeannie. I'm just overjoyed. It's so convenient. And
review it. Put it on Facebook, please.
Well, it's such a freedom to be free of papers everywhere. So that's my favorite thing, besides being able to just do it right in the moment, right when you think of it, and not have to go find a paper and sit down and, you know, anyway. So I wanted to say that, and then I wanted to say that I'm working on accounts for Food Fund and Forgiveness, so I was texting Jeannie about that, and let's see, what else? I got great news. I went to the eye doctor this morning. Hallelujah. And, yeah, am I better? No, but she said I do not have to take steroids, and she supports me 100% in choosing to do my healing work. And so that's all great news. And
awesome.
The other thing is that there's a large controversy going on right now about privacy and the betrayal, if you will, of Facebook in selling people's private information, not to mention compromising people's security with respect to identity theft and the federal government and elections. And I think that people might want to consider that Facebook is, you know, a $350 billion company that's a for-profit company, and they don't necessarily have your best interest at heart. Just something to consider.
Yeah, definitely something to look at. Actually, one article I've read, you know, as a result of this whole schmozzle, I've been doing a little bit of research, and one perception, of course, this is a perception, how closely does it match actuality, I don't know, but this one security researcher said that one of the greatest rebranding jobs that has been done in the digital world is that surveillance companies have been rebranded as social media companies.
Exactly.
His take is that these are actually surveillance companies, and that they've rebranded them to make them look like what they're not. And that's, of course, right back to the game of sophistry and the next opportunity to learn forgiveness if that brings something up for us and to choose to withdraw, which I'm actually in the process of doing.
Yeah, I am too. And you know, for a long time, I had a internal niggling of there's something about this that feels off to me. I wasn't able to articulate at all what it was, but boy, is it clear to me now. I appreciate your contribution along that line.
Well, it's interesting, you know, if you dig in. There you go.
Yes, go ahead.
It's interesting if you dig in and really look at that whole thing. Two people from that company ended up in Theresa May's office on Downing Street, which is the government of Britain. And the gentleman who we've heard all about as being from Breitbart actually was the vice president of that company, ended up in the White House. Steve Bannon was the vice president of that company. So three people from those offices are in two of the largest governments and war-making governments in the world. Might be something to look at and do some work around too. So, hey, who knows what comes out of all of this healing that takes place?
Well, one of the things that occurs to me too is you've had in history, there have been these things called a Ponzi scheme where someone, some kind of like a financial planner type of thing to get your information, get your money, and then they go spend it, and then people whose life savings has just disappeared. Because whoever this person was that created the scheme didn't have that love present, that consciousness of what we all are as, you know, our fellow man, that love resonance, like there wasn't any. There's just no conscience. And it occurred to me that they have Zuckerberg in congressional hearings and asking them, what are you going to do about it going forward? What is going to be put in place such that people's identity and numbers and all that isn't compromised, and that you have.
We're going to be cut off. The show. We're down to the last 3 or 4 seconds, so we'll just say have the best year yet of your eternal life. Do your work around it, and we'll begin our conversation tomorrow. Blessings.
Blessings.